She was old, but we loved her.
We put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into that boat. There's no doubt about that.
A fishing crew in Bristol Bay narrowly escapes their sinking vessel. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, July 18th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a diesel spill in Gamble goes undetected for 2 weeks.
The fuel went through this underground piping, and it obviously was compromised.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
A preliminary report on last week's non-fatal plane crash on Prince of Wales Island indicates that the Temsco Air pilot became disoriented after weather conditions deteriorated during the flight to Ketchikan. The National Transportation Safety Board report summarized a conversation between investigators and the pilot, identified by Alaska State Troopers as 72-year-old Mike Hudgens. Hudgens told investigators soon after the July 10th accident that while flying over Sulzer Portage, visibility decreased rapidly to zero. He tried to turn back, but while turning, saw what he thought was a body of water. He told investigators that that's when he became disoriented and leveled the wings before realizing he was flying towards snow-covered mountains. Hudgens reported he pulled the de Havilland Otter into a steep climb, but wasn't able to avoid hitting the rocky mountainside. At impact, the plane's floats were sheared off, and there was substantial damage to the rest of the plane, according to the report. All 11 on board survived the crash, about 2,000 feet up Mount Jumbo near Heidelberg. Six were seriously injured, according to the report, and four received minor injuries. The pilot was not injured. Investigators also talked to two passengers for the preliminary report. Both confirmed the weather was poor and said they were concerned during the flight. One said he texted the front seat passenger, asking him to suggest landing on the water to wait for better weather. The crash was called in by the pilot shortly before 9 a.m. on July 10th. The U.S. Coast Guard and local rescue groups were able to find the site and get everyone to Ketchikan by mid-afternoon. Hundreds of drift boats are in Bristol Bay's Nooshigak District fishing this summer's record-breaking sockeye run. Over the weekend, disaster struck one vessel when the strong current sucked it between two much larger ships. KDLG's Avery Lill has the story.
Shortly after midnight on Saturday, July 14th, the fishing vessel Christie lost power. As the tide carried them, the boat floated in the current at 5 knots. Its skipper, Jan Medhog, and deckhand Kyle Brzezikowski worked to restore power to the 32-foot aluminum drift boat. Medhog's wife, Kayla Breeden, went to the stern to hang a protective buoy.
When you're out there fishing for that many days, you just think kind of everything is mundane. So I grabbed my buoy to go out there, but I didn't even put, you know, my rain jacket on, and I almost didn't put my boots on because we thought we were going to clear her.
She could see two large ships, which she estimated were 3 football fields away. The 330-foot-long fish processing vessel Gordon Jensen and the even larger cargo ship Soho. They were anchored about 15 feet from each other. 10 seconds later, after Breeden hung the buoy, the Christie struck the Gordon Jensen. Medhog explained what happened next.
We ended up getting jammed in between the two vessels, pushed up against their Yokohama fender that was between the two of them. We started to violently smash between the two vessels.
The fender, a giant rubber cylinder filled with air and designed to protect the two larger ships from damaging one another, pinned the Christie at the bow. The aluminum boat bounced between the two steel ships.
You could hear it crushing the boat in between. Aluminum is strong, but it's not stronger than steel and water with all that pressure. So she cried and moaned and banged really bad for quite a while.
Medhog radioed the Gordon Jensen for assistance. The fish processor lifted Breeden off the embattled boat in a man basket. Medhog and Brzezikowski attempted to situate the Christie so that she could stay afloat through the incoming tide. They hoped to extricate her from between the ships at slack tide when the boat would no longer be pinned to the fender. From her position on the Gordon Jensen, however, Breeden could see that the men were in more danger than they knew.
And our boat is not a flat deck. We've got a pit in the back for picking, so more water was building up in there. Our deckhand, right before they decided to get off, heard the crying moan of metal twisting. I don't know if you can describe it, but when you hear it, you know, and you leave.
Medhug and Brojakowski finally clambered onto the fender moments before the Christie capsized, bow over stern, and sank beneath the waves in seconds.
As Jan was stepping off the bow, the stern was taking on all the water and starting to curl under. So 2 seconds later, and he probably wouldn't have been able to get off.
The Gordon Jensen brought Medhug and Brojakowski aboard in the same man basket that had rescued Breeden just 20 minutes earlier.
So finally, when the guys did get lifted off, I ran up and we all three hugged each other, just like out of a movie.
In the aftermath of the disaster, many loose ends remain. The United States Coast Guard is investigating the incident. Right now, it is not assigning fault in the accident to any party. The senior investigating officer did note that the anchor line aboard the Christie was not long enough to be useful in this situation, where it was drifting in water 40 to 50 feet deep.
You know, certainly an anchor might have helped in this case. I mean, situational awareness is always key, and having the right equipment, you know, knowing your operation, having the right equipment can obviously prevent disasters.
The captains of the Soho and Gordon Jensen have not reported any damage to their vessels. The United States Coast Guard will work with Medhug on a salvage plan to mitigate any hazards the sunken vessel poses, including pollution risk related to the diesel fuel that was aboard the boat. Medhug and Breeden flew back to their home in Seattle on Monday, but they plan to return next year.
We're hoping to get a safe boat, and we're probably going to bring our kids next year. What happened to us was a very fluke thing. There wasn't really anything we could have done differently, and I don't think that it could happen again to somebody, but I think we can all learn from what did happen, and thank God for all the other fishermen out there that help each other in the way that it is here in Alaska and on the river.
With help from KDLG's Austin Fast, I'm Avery Lill in Dillingham.
Former Republican Governor Sean Parnell endorsed Mike Dunleavy for governor on Tuesday. Parnell said in a post on Dunleavy's Facebook page of the former Wasilla State Senator, quote, "When Mike tells you something, you can believe it," end quote. Parnell didn't give his endorsement to his former running mate, Meade Treadwell. Treadwell served as lieutenant governor in Parnell's administration. The announcement came the same day that Treadwell said he has the business experience needed to be governor and Dunleavy doesn't. Yesterday, Treadwell held the first press conference of his campaign to be the Republican candidate for governor. He says Dunleavy didn't fulfill his commitment to voters since he didn't serve his entire term. And he says Dunleavy could have done more to repeal the controversial criminal justice law known as Senate Bill 91.
I don't have any negative say about Mike except where have you been? Having a fuss and leaving the Senate did not protect your PFD. He wasn't there when there was a vote on the Permanent Fund Protection Act. He wasn't there when Mia Costello was looking for co-sponsors to repeal SB 91. He wasn't there when the amendments to SB 91 were passed. He stood for election and told people he was going to serve for 4 years, and he didn't.
Dunleavy campaign manager Brett Huber says Treadwell, quote, has dusted off his old unsuccessful playbook of attacking the front runner without adding anything useful to the debate, end quote. The primary is August 21st. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tribal courts gain more authority for Native communities.
All people, they just make bad choices. We always give them an opportunity to change.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
A failed pipeline in the community of Gamble on St. Lawrence Island caused an estimated 2,500 gallons of diesel fuel to spill in late June. It was only discovered last week. That's according to the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. Tom DeRider is the department's state on-scene coordinator. He says on June 25th, fuel was being delivered through a 4-inch pipeline leading from the barge landing to the Bering Strait School District and Gamble Native Store tank farms.
The fuel went through this underground piping, and it obviously was compromised. A subsequent pressure test on the line indicated that it would not hold pressure, and we're certain that that was the source of the release.
According to the DEC Situation Report, BSSD received the full amount of fuel it ordered. DeRuyter says the Native Store's records show it didn't. That's where the estimate of 2,300 to 2,800 gallons of spilled fuel comes from. But the problem went unnoticed until last week when people in the community reported smelling diesel and seeing a sheen in a small pond. DeRuyter says Coast Guard and DEC responders arrived last Friday to investigate. He says they're still not sure of the full extent of the spill.
There's no reports of oil getting out into the Bering Sea. Those are the only areas where fuel has been noted.
He says the water supply has not been compromised since Gamble doesn't get its water from ground wells. According to DeRuyter, the valves on both ends of the pipeline have been closed. This is the second fuel spill this year on St. Lawrence Island after more than 20,000 gallons spilled in Savoonga in late March. Matanuska-Susitna Borough officials are considering whether to provide police services to residents who live outside city police department's jurisdiction. Part of the ongoing discussion is whether the borough should ask Mat-Su voters this fall if that's something they even want from the borough. The borough cites as its impetus rising crime in the region and a decline in services from the Alaska State Troopers. Several options have come up, including what would likely be an expensive expansion of the city police department's service areas. Another idea would be to give the borough policing responsibilities, possibly similar to a sheriff's department. But the borough says any option would require raising taxes. And Mat-Su Borough Assembly Member Jim Sykes wants to ask residents what they think in an advisory vote this October.
I think we just need to ask the question, are you satisfied really with the way things are? Or do you believe that the borough should be involved in police powers? It recognizes that we do have a problem. I think it's our responsibility to at least ask the public if we should take a first step, and that's all this is.
That's Sykes speaking at last night's assembly meeting. He says if voters support the idea of some kind of borough police powers, it would then be up to the borough to look more closely at the different possibilities and levels of service. Sykes says any specific plan would be put to a vote. The assembly members' comments were mixed on the idea of asking voters. Assemblymember George McGee says he does not support the advisory vote because the borough has not given voters enough detail to make an informed decision.
This is one of those things that when you go out and you're going to tell people, we can provide you a service and it's going to cost you some money, but we really don't know how much, okay? That's not good enough for me.
McGee also says almost none of his constituents have told him they are willing to pay more in taxes for borough police service. The assembly voted to postpone any further action on the proposal until July 31st. This week, Indigenous people from four Arctic countries are gathered in Utqiagvik for the Inuit Circumpolar Council's 2018 General Assembly. ICC advocates for the rights of the Inuit at the local, regional, and international levels. Ravenna Koenig from Alaska's Energy Desk is there and has this report.
At the high school gym in Utqiagvik, there's a sign for the high school's Barrow Whalers and flags strung in front of it representing America, Canada, Greenland, and Russia. Over 800 people are at this event. Some of them are from here, in Utqiagvik, but others have flown in from towns like Nome, Kotzebue, and St. Lawrence Island, as well as the countries represented by those international flags. You see a lot of people embracing friends that they haven't seen in a while, and the feeling is definitely one of reunion. This group was founded back in the 1970s on the idea that even though borders had been drawn throughout the Arctic, the common history, culture, and language of the people who live here unites them, and that they should have an organization that advocates for their common interests. Cordelia Kelly splits her time between Anchorage and Utqiagvik, but she made sure to be in town for the event.
As Inuit people, we have more in common with those that are, you know, east and west of us than the north and south. We really are the same people. We are one people with one shared homeland and language and a shared culture.
The ICC helps to shape Arctic policy on the international stage, like at the UN and the Arctic Council. And at this week's meeting, the ICC is talking about a whole range of issues, including food security, climate change, economic development, and language loss. They'll elect new leadership and come up with a document that will guide their priorities till the next General Assembly 4 years down the road. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Ravenna Koenig, Inutkeavik.
The National Park Service could once again allow controversial techniques like bear baiting on certain public lands. They announced today that they're extending the public comment period because of high public interest in the proposed change. The Park Service outlawed certain sport hunting and trapping techniques on National Preserve lands, like using artificial light to trap bears at their den sites, taking wolves and coyotes during the denning season, and hunting swimming caribou in 2015. The changes contradicted State of Alaska regulations that allow the practices. State Park Service spokesperson Pete Christian says the original regulation passed because the hunting practices conflicted with Park Service values.
Park purposes and values require the Park Service to manage its national interest lands for ecosystems, and changing predator-prey balances isn't what the Park Service mandate is for.
Opponents of the practices argue they're unnecessarily cruel and jeopardize public safety. Now the Park Service is considering overturning its 2015 rule. That's in response to two statements by Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke last year that encouraged the Park Service to align state and federal hunting regulations.
Since then, we've had a change in administrations, and we have a new Secretary of the Interior whose priorities are to increase opportunities for hunting and enhance hunting and recreational opportunities on public lands.
The agency has received more than 70,000 public comments on the proposed change, some of them duplicates. Christian says generally the comments are in favor of keeping the 2015 rule in place and prohibiting the controversial practices on public lands.
So what we'll do is we'll take all of the comment as it comes in and evaluate it, and substantive comments will be considered in the final rule.
The public comment period has been extended until September 6th to allow the Park Service time to complete an environmental assessment and ensure that the general public and state and local groups have time to respond. Over the past year, the Walker administration has worked out the details of its pledge to recognize Alaska Natives' right to govern themselves. Tribes are assuming authority over child welfare cases, certain education programs, and law enforcement. And in communities like Mountain Village, tribal court systems are drawing on traditional views of justice to help residents rebuild their lives rather than just punishing them. KYUK's Teresa Katsourilis has more.
The first thing that Judge Eugene Landlord does is listen. He watches his client's body language. There's a certain look in their eyes that he tries to keep track of. If they seem depressed or at risk of harming themselves, he gives them his phone number.
I tell them that I'm available 24 hours a day, it doesn't matter. And there's been two or three instances where this occurred. Those people are still here.
Eugene Landlord is an elder judge in the tribal court system of Mountain Village, and his job is different from his Western counterparts. Landlord focuses on his community's health as well as its public safety. He arbitrates domestic violence and child protection cases, and he counsels community members with substance abuse issues, too. Mountain Village's tribal court practices restorative justice, and Landlord says that's pretty different from most Western court systems, where many defendants are sent to prison without being offered services that could help them take a different path.
All people are good. They just make bad choices. And we always give them the opportunity to change.
Landlord's a little young to be an elder. He's in his late 50s. But Mountain Village tribal officials kept asking him to join the court. He finally did about 4 years ago. He struggled with alcoholism and substance abuse, and while he's been sober for years, that experience informs his work. People with that background are more effective, he says. When community members petition for substance abuse counseling, Landlord and two other judges review the case and figure out a treatment plan. The court's tribal administrator usually schedules weekly or biweekly meetings between Landlord and the client. Landlord draws on a range of tools in those sessions. Some of them come from Alcoholics Anonymous. He's also read a lot of self-help books. But he says he tries to steer away from Western styles of treatment. 30-day or 90-day rehabs set time limits on recovery, and Landlord says that just isn't helpful.
Sometimes you're really reluctant to open up, and we have to find ways to let them open up, and one of the ways we do it is to share our stories of how we overcame some of these substance abuse problems, and that sort of breaks the ice, and that's really, really rewarding.
Cases that involve domestic violence can be a lot harder. Mountain Village's tribal court system handles a lot of elder and child protection cases.
They're the ones that are caught in the middle. And it's not easy sometimes finding solutions, but we do find solutions.
While the court's been doing well, landlord says that he'd appreciate further education or training if the state begins to refer particularly serious cases to him, like sex assault cases, particularly serious domestic violence cases, or those involving the mentally ill. In the meantime, Mountain Village's tribal justice system is expanding. The tribe organized its own Department of Justice in February, and it includes a series of wellness programs to help sex abuse and domestic violence survivors heal through traditional practices. The department's focus is not punishment. It's healing and finding solutions. In Bethel, I'm Teresa Katsourilis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
The World Eskimo Indian Olympics get underway in Fairbanks today. WEO draws Indigenous athletes from Alaska, Canada, and beyond. WEO features a full range of traditional sports like the high kick and stick pull, as well as native music and dance at the Carlson Center through Saturday. Fairbanks has hosted the games for 58 years, and as KUAC's Robin reports, they have slowly changed over the decades.
Setting up in the Carlson Center provides enough space for 4 days of athletics, dance, artwork, regalia, and cultural pageantry. Gina Kallock, the chair of the Board of Governors, says WEO has evolved from a small family event in 1961 into one of Fairbanks' favorite festivals.
And in growth, you have to make compromises, and sometimes things change a little bit. But that's a sign that it's healthy and that it's sustainable and that we can still be here for another, what, we're on 58 years this year.
There is a new logo this year by an Alaska Native artist, a clause about gender in published materials, explaining why traditional games sometimes include just one gender, and a change to the dancing from competition to festival, inviting groups to dance for the sheer love of it. The traditional games have not changed. The knuckle hop is still a knuckle hop, laborious and painful. The high kicks are still a high kicks, full of suspense and athleticism. And the blanket toss is still the blanket toss, a showy group effort that reminds one of the subsistence lifestyle from which the games derive.
Anything to survive has to be passed on to the next generation. And that's our whole purpose. And our mission statement is to preserve and promote the native arts and dance and athletics. You talk to anybody who comes and they'll say it's like a family reunion.
Kallock says the games always honor native elders, but this year it's a special theme.
This year we wanted to state the fact that we celebrate our elders, and without them, none of this would be able to be happening. They advise us, they correct us, they cheer us on, and they're the ones we've learned how to do this from.
As part of the opening ceremonies, Pauline Demoski Carlo will be remembered. Carlo was an advocate for Native people and known at WEO as Tender of the Seal Oil Lamp, the equivalent of an Olympic torch. Carlo died last spring. In Fairbanks, I'm Robin.
While it's no secret that there's a sizable gun-owning community in Sitka, it also happens to be co-ed. At the Sitka Sportsmen's Association indoor shooting range, the fastest-growing user demographic is female. KCAW's Catherine Rose reports on a new pistol clinic tailored especially for women.
All right, good evening, shooters. We're going to start the live fire warm-up. We're going to do it in 5-round increments.
I'm standing at the back of an indoor gun range, looking over the shoulders of 8 women as they stare down the dimly lit blue tunnel toward targets made out of old fish boxes and wait for the signal.
Ready on the firing line. Commence. Fire.
Using anywhere from 22 to 40 caliber pistols, these women practice shooting, some with little experience and some with quite a bit. Steve Ramp of the Sitka Sportsmen's Association leads the course and said after 3 years of a women's pistol league in the fall, women were asking for more opportunities to shoot.
In December, several of the shooters approached me and says, "We don't want to wait till next September to shoot again. Can you do something in the meantime?"
So they created the Women's Pistol Clinic, a four-week course designed to teach women the basics of how to use a firearm, from gun safety to tricks that improve aim and accuracy.
It might be sexist, but it's always been a guy thing to go out and shoot guns. Mm-hmm. And in America, we're seeing more and more women and get involved in the shooting sports, and it's awesome. It's not a guy thing like it used to be.
That's why he says having women coaches like Kelly Godin is helpful.
My role is mostly just line coaching and just being a helper, being a female on the range to help make things a little more comfortable for some of the ladies. And just to help them to gain some confidence and to see that it's not just a men's thing, that women can do it too.
She's been around guns most of her life. Her husband is the commander at the State Trooper Academy, and he's a coach at the women's clinic here tonight. But she only started shooting a few years ago, and she's good. Godin won the Women's Pistol League last fall.
I thought it was going to go off. Yeah, but if I knew there was something in there, I wanted to...
No. Godin and two other coaches work with the women on trigger pulls, doing a ball and dummy test to see if they're jerking the trigger or keeping it steady when they shoot. When the shooters turn their backs, the coaches load a single round into some of the pistols and leave some empty. Then the women turn toward the range and, without knowing if their gun is loaded or not, take a shot.
And it'll be a visual cue to them that, oh, I really am jerking the trigger, mm-hmm. which is probably the most common cause for people not shooting up to their potential, whether they're men or women.
Participant Andrea Turner says she's happy Godin is there. It does change the student-teacher dynamic.
There are different things, like she was talking about holding a gun out at arm's length in front of you and how it uses these muscles that we're not used to. And women just biologically don't have the same type of upper body strength as men do. And so there are biological aspects of shooting that are going to be different for men versus women. And so having her perspective on this it's really comforting.
Ramp and Godin say that programs like this have helped the Sportsmen's Association see a big jump in women's participation.
It's been really impressive. When we started the Women's Pistol League 3 years ago, I want to say there was about 10 ladies in league. And this past year, I think we ended with 28.
But it's not all good news. That means more competition for Godin this fall at the Pistol League.
Some of their groups are pretty impressive. I'm not sure I want to shoot against them.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Gabe Colombo in Nome, Casey Grove and Aaron McKinstry in Anchorage, Ravenna Koenig in Utqiagvik, Teresa Katsarilis in Bethel, Robin in Fairbanks, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Do you want to work at a job that contributes to the health of your community? Well, Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, is hiring. SEARCH offers full-time jobs that include health, vision, and dental benefits, as well as paid time off and retirement savings. For more information, visit search.org/jobs and view open positions. Start a rewarding career helping others at SEARCH. Healthy is here. This message sponsored by the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.